book of Daniel and chapter 3. The book of Daniel and chapter 3. Verse 1. Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold, whose height was 80 cubits, and the breadth thereof 6 cubits. He set it up in the plain of Dura, in the province of Babylon. Then Nebuchadnezzar the king sent to gather together the princes, the governors, the captains, the judges, the treasurers, the counselors, the sheriffs, and all the rulers of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image which Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. Then the princes, the governors, and the captains, the judges, the treasurers, the counselors, the sheriffs, and all the rulers of the provinces were gathered together unto the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up, and they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then a herald cried aloud, "To you it is commanded, O people, nations, and languages, that at what time ye hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, dulcimer, and all kinds of music, ye fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king hath set up. And whoso falleth not down and worshippeth, shall the same hour be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace." Verse 8. Wherefore at that time certain Chaldeans came near and accused the Jews. They spake and said to the king Nebuchadnezzar, "O king, live forever. Thou, O king, hast made a decree that every man that shall hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and dulcimer, and all kinds of music shall fall down and worship the golden image." Verse 12, "There are certain Jews whom thou hast set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have not regarded thee. They serve not thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up." Then Nebuchadnezzar, in his rage and fury, commanded to bring. The end of the verse, "They brought these men." Nebuchadnezzar spake and said unto them, "Is it true?" Now, verse 15, he says, "If ye be ready." The end of the verse, "But if ye worship not, ye shall be cast the same hour into the midst of a burning fiery furnace, and who is that God that shall deliver you out of my hands?" Then we have their answer, verse 17, "If it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of thine hand, O king. But if not, be it known unto thee, O king, that we will not serve thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up." And then we have them cast. Verse 21, "These men were bound in their coats, their hosen, and their hats, and their other garments, and were cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace." Verse 24, I'm sorry for abbreviating the reading, but it's a long chapter. Verse 24, "Then Nebuchadnezzar the king was astonished and rose up." Indeed, I would need to read verse 23, and that's a key verse for my message. "And these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell down bound into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Then Nebuchadnezzar the king was astonished." Verse 25, "He answered and said, Lo, I see four men loose, walking in the midst of the fire, and they have no hurt, and the form of the fourth is like the Son of God." And then they're released. Verse 27, "And the princes, governors, and captains, and the king's counselors being gathered together, saw these men, upon whose bodies the fire had no power, nor was a hair of their head singed, neither were their coats changed, nor the smell of fire had passed on them. Then Nebuchadnezzar spake and said, Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who hath sent his angel and delivered his servants that trusted in him, and have changed the king's word and yielded their bodies, that they might not serve nor worship any god except their own God. Therefore I make a decree that every people, nation, and language which speak anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, and their houses shall be made a dunghill, because there is no other God that can deliver after this sort." Then the king promoted. Now that will do a lengthy yet broken reading from the scriptures. I think by now the obscurity of what we were attempting to do has just about disappeared. Many of you were wondering at the start of the meetings when we spoke about looking at Bible triplets. what exactly we were going to consider and how we were ever going to make head or tail of such a widespread subject as Bible triplets. However, we have very, very quickly defined the specifics of our subject and have indicated, until you're almost weary, I'm sure, listening to it, that we are thinking especially of the seven groups. There will be two of them untouched because we have only five nights. But thinking of the seven groups in the Bible who are described as these three. We have already thought about three in a city from the book of Ezekiel chapter 14. We thought then about three in a family, that very wonderful family of Moses, Aaron, and Miriam. Last night we considered three of David's mighty men, three in an army. And as we have already indicated on previous occasions, our subject tonight will be to think about three in an emergency, leaving us to consider three on a journey tomorrow night in the will of the Lord. Here we have it in the verse that I almost omitted reading. These three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell down bound into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. We feel an admiration in our hearts for these three men. We will never be able to fill a chapter such as they filled, but if we could even take a page out of their book, well, it would do us good, I think, in our Christian testimony. I can't go into the book of Daniel, and there is no real temptation to do that. Actually, this chapter, as far as I know, this third chapter of the book of Daniel is the only one of the 12 chapters which doesn't mention Daniel's name or doesn't have a personal reference, I. Neither his name nor a pronoun. So that while Daniel features very widely in the other 11 chapters, he is not mentioned at all in this chapter. So that allows us to take the chapter out, to look at it in isolation in a single meeting, and we don't have to spend time talking too much about the book of Daniel. I remember I was just a short time saved, and there was a brother gave us ministry in Lurgan, and he said a thing about the book of Daniel that I have never forgotten. I didn't really understand it then, and I found it helpful since. He said that the book of Daniel was historical prophecy, because Daniel received prophecies in history, and many of them have already been fulfilled in history. It was historical prophecy. And then he went on to say that another section of the book of Daniel was prophetic history. So that when things are being told in the book of Daniel, while they have happened in history, those things which happened in history are foreshadowings of things that will happen in a future day. Historical prophecy and prophetic history. Well, we really more or less believe in both those aspects of consideration in this meeting, and we will be considering this passage in a very, very simple, practical way. Concerning these three men, the one feature that we will mainly be emphasizing is their faith. Now, the word faith does not occur in the chapter. It does speak about them trusting, and yet I would find it difficult to think that even though these three men are not mentioned by name, in Hebrews chapter 11, I cannot help but suspect that when the writer gave a summary at the end of the chapter and said, by faith, the subdued kingdoms stopped the mouth of lions, quenched the violence of the fire, you would have trouble convincing me that at least this chapter wasn't in the background of that expression. By faith, they quenched the violence of the fire. So that we'd be looking at faith in a furnace. Faith in a crucible of affliction. You know, in this chapter, Nebuchadnezzar had his image, the image of gold. But in the furnace, I can see another image. I think that in that furnace there were three men, and they were reflecting the image of God. And God had produced in the lives of those three boys a masterpiece of grace which Nebuchadnezzar could never produce. That's what it's all about, really, when all is said and done. The Lord is wanting to reproduce his own image in us. That cannot be done in metal without a fire. And it seems to me that as far as most of the believers are concerned, they don't get through life without furnaces, without fire. Those furnaces may be painful at the time, but they will be eternally profitable if they make the image appear a little bit more clear. The faith, we'll be looking mainly at the faith of these three men. And that will be slightly different to our previous considerations. You remember when we thought about the three in a city, we considered mainly their fidelity. They were righteous men, Noah, Job, and Daniel, their fidelity. You remember when we considered the three in a family, we thought about their fellowship and their fame. There was a friction came in that day, but there was a beautiful fellowship in that family, and even though it was interrupted for a little while, they got it repaired. You remember last night when we thought about three in the army, those men that could stand with unflinching courage and could halt the Philistine invasion, we thought about their fortitude. But tonight, when it's three in an emergency, we will mainly think about their faith. Now, the first thing that I want to mention, to come right away to the chapter, I want to think about the challenge to the faith of these three boys. It came, really, in the course of their employment. These men were employed, as you know, by Nebuchadnezzar, the great king of Babylon. In his employment, they were coming right up against the cool face of Gentile heathendom. And these men were up against the cool face, and by their faith they met the challenge head on. That's why chapters like these are so precious in our Bible. You know, when you get into the position that I happen to be in with other good brethren, here and other countries and so on, there can be a wee bit of artificiality about preaching, in the sense that most of your time, or at least a great proportion of your time, can be spent amongst the Lord's people. But I know that I'm speaking to some in this meeting tonight, and some who have been here on previous nights and generally in meetings, and only a very, very small proportion of your time is spent within the walls of a gospel hall. You spend 12 hours a day up against the cold face of a cold world. Your employment, your business, the university, your studies, and you're up against a hostile environment. And so that when we come to the Bible, we really appreciate a passage like this that shows us men who could stand against the odds. Now, the challenge came right in their employment. It was this great image. Nebuchadnezzar made this image of 60 cubits high and 6 cubits wide, whatever it was, put it in the plain of Dura. This image of gold. Where did he get the idea of this image? Well, I'm going to have to nearly go back on what I said. Just for 30 seconds, I want to slip into another part of the book of Daniel. You remember in the previous chapter, this very same man had been given a dream from God. And in that dream there was an image of a human figure. I think that this was probably an image of a human figure. Others have different ideas, but I don't think it was a bird, and I don't think it was a calf. I think this was the image of a man. It was only one-tenth at the waist what it was height-wise. Be an interesting proportion for some of us. If I was 10 times as high as I am at the waist, well, I think my head would be outside nearly. It was just didn't have human proportions. Maybe there was a big pedestal at the bottom of it. I'm not altogether sure, but I still think it was a kind of a human form. The one that God showed Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 2, you remember the gold? Then there would be a new empire, silver, another empire with brass further down, and right down to the feet, an empire of iron and clay. And that was always changing in... Oh, no, Nebuchadnezzar says, no way. No way, he says. He says, it's always going to be me. This image was gold from the top of the head to the tips of his toe. God had told Nebuchadnezzar in the previous chapter, you are the head of gold, but after you, it will pass to somebody else, after them to another, and after them to another. No, no, Nebuchadnezzar says, I want to stay. I want it the whole way. And by making this great big image of gold, he got the idea from God, but he twisted this idea with his own sense of self-importance. And he said, really? It was a big display of himself. He says, I'm going to reign forever. It'll be me the whole way. The idea was a divine original, prostituted by human pride. Then it came to the inauguration of this great image. Actually, I think that Nebuchadnezzar had a number of things in mind, and I have to take the time to mention some of these things to get the point later in the story. His empire had expanded. In that expanding empire, he had included under the boundaries of his control many different nations. Those different nations had their own religions, their own gods, and their own culture. And there were so many nations. I think that Nebuchadnezzar was becoming a wee bit concerned that there's so much diversity in my empire that I would need to do something to create a bit of unity. And he says, I'll tell you what I'll do. He says, I'll make this marvelous great big image. And I'll put it on that big plain about 12 miles from Babylon. And he said, I'll gather representatives from right across my vast empire. You heard the sheriffs, the treasurers, the captains, the presidents, the whole... He said, I'll advertise it and I'll get them all to come in a massive great big crowd. And he says, I'll use this new religion as the cement that will bind my diversified empire together. He was no dozer. He was no dozer. This old boy Nebuchadnezzar, don't think it for a minute. He said, I must not only have politics, but he says, I have to have religion. And he says, if I can get political power, and if I can marry to political power a common religion, he says, it will really give me a special hold upon the people. So he gets them all gathered, a massive crowd. It was one of the most wonderful ecumenical meetings that you could ever think about. All shades and grades, all classes, all types, all cultures, all opinions, and they're all there in one great big forum, the Plain of Jura. Plenty of space. Probably a great big plain with hills on either side. The sight was absolutely stupendous, and the sound was wonderful. He had the latest U2 bands all over the place. And every kind of instrument, sackbut and psaltery and dulcimer and harp, he had all those. And he said, do you see the way those boys can play? Well, he said, they have got different instruments. They have all been orchestrated together. And he said, just as these different instruments produce a beautiful harmony of sound. He said, I want this new religion to produce a new unity of empire. Different instruments, all one. Different nations, all one. And with this wonderful music, he created a very fine atmosphere. And then, of course, at the proper signal, at the proper signal, the idolatry of all this appeared. Everybody bowed down. If you can just imagine that. I don't think I'm exaggerating when I would say that right up until now, Nebuchadnezzar had had many big days in his empire, but this was one of the biggest so far.
Never had there been a gathering like this. This was just at the zenith of his pride. There never had been a showcase day like this for the grand Nebuchadnezzar. Everybody's down flat. Except for these three men. These three men. That's why we're looking at them tonight. These three men had a challenge to their faith. What are they going to do? Now, it's all right for us because we're out on the other side. We know the end of the story. Don't forget these men didn't know it. Because with that image and with those marvelous instruments at the inauguration of this new world worship, there had also been put in at the bottom an awful solemn note of intimidation. And he said to all the great people, because he wasn't sure that it would work, he said, "Now I tell you, if you don't come," he says, "you'll go to the fire." And he said, "if you don't bow," he says, "you'll burn." And when the signal was given, and possibly hundreds of thousands, I don't know, hundreds, thousands upon thousands, when every one of them just bowed, there wasn't a single man, I would say, in that company bowed out of love. They all bowed out of fear. They bowed because they had to, not because they wanted to. That wasn't much use as a religion. Sure it wasn't. Has human religion changed? Any of you good men could stand up and tell me, from the various contacts that you have made in life, how many millions of people there are in this world, and as year follows year, they go through the rigmarole of religion, not because they love it, or certainly not because they love God, or even love it. They have so much superstition in their hearts that they do this because they're scared stiff to think of what might happen if they don't do it. That's Babylonish religion. It's with us to the present day, especially encased in one system that we hear about from time to time. I'm not going to go any further than that. So here's this whole setup now. You can see it. I'm taking a minute or two just to draw the picture. On the one hand, the landscape is dominated by this image. The splendor of that image must have been very impressive. When the sun shone upon it, as it would do in the eastern country, the splendor of that image. Then over here, not too far away, is the smoke of the incinerator. And every man there knows, I will either bow before the splendor of this image, or I will add to the smoke of the incinerator. How are these men's faith going to stand up to the fire? It's tough. Maybe we leave all that for a second. Maybe I'm speaking just tonight in this meeting to somebody today. And today, you have been under pressure. Now, can you imagine the pressure that these three boys must have felt under? There was, first of all, political pressure, because they knew that this boy's not a boy to be thankful, but if you dare to even say boo against him, he just blasts you into kingdom come. Whom he would he slew? And whom he would he kept alive? He's a totalitarian tyrant. He's dreadful, this man. He would just think no less of cutting off your head than he would of killing a pig. This will maybe be the call of the captive. Dare you stand against me, and I will throw you into that furnace the way you would throw a spider into it. There was political pressure because these boys knew not only lose their job, but lose their life. Then there was peer pressure. They're three taking a stand, and everybody else is flat on his face. What better do? You can't make a fool of yourself. You can't stick out like a sore thumb. Sure, it'll only take 2 minutes, and the whole thing will be over. And when we are down on our face, we can say within our hearts, we know that the little image is really nothing. We really believe in God. We know it's nothing. And we'll save our skin, and we'll save our skin, and we'll get away with it. Save their skin, yes. Maybe they could have, but they would have stained their soul. And then there was the psychological pressure. Just the fear. You think of these men, maybe their families, and all connected with it. Is there a brother or a sister, maybe some of the students here tonight, we're glad to see you again. Some of you other brethren in business, maybe this day that's passed, you have been under pressure. Many a Christian has gone to a big do and taken a drink because everybody was doing it. Many a man in business signed a check and did a dirty deed and told a lie. Because if I don't, Nebuchadnezzar said, he said, you'll do it or you'll be fired. And when he said fired, he meant fired. Real fired. Do you say, if I do that, I'll be out without a job? You see the pressure? You know, we're living, dear brothers and sisters, I don't need to tell you, we're living in days of tremendous pressure. Actually, these three men, I may be able to say one or two things in a few minutes that would be to the credit of sisters. But I just say now, although we talk a lot about these three men during the meeting, I'm not forgetting about the sisters. Indeed, I would say that in most cases, because of the structure of our modern evil society and its immorality and all the things that go with it, I would say that godly sisters are under more pressure than brethren in many cases, if not most cases. Now, the pressure is on for a sister working in an office, being at a university. Most of them will dress in ways that you would, and you really feel conspicuous. Imagine, when these boys turned around and saw the others happening, you can imagine the looks they got. The challenge to the faith of these three men. I want to speak about the criticism of their faith. It tells us in verse number 8, at that time certain Chaldeans came near and accused the Jews and said, O king of Babylon, these men have not regarded thee. They do not serve thy gods. They do not worship the golden image which thou hast set up. These were a crafty bunch of boys. You know, I never like anybody that tells tales behind another person's back anyway. But that's beside the point. It was more serious than this. It says they went and they accused the Jews. Now that word accused is a very strong word. It actually means to pull the flesh off their backs and to chop up the pieces and eat the pieces. We would say in our colloquial language that they just cut them to bits. And they told Nebuchadnezzar. Now, you might have noticed it was very repetitive, I felt, in the reading. See, there's a thing I'll say to younger brethren here. If you're reading a chapter of the Bible, it's a good thing to read it out loud to yourself if you really want to get the sense, because you will notice things reading a chapter of the Bible out loud that you never notice just reading it into yourself. So if you can get a room where you'll be far enough away that the people will not think you're going a wee bit and talking to yourself and all that, it will be a good thing just to read out the Bible. And now, you kept noticing, it says, the image which Nebuchadnezzar set up. The great image which Nebuchadnezzar set up. The image which Nebuchadnezzar set up. The image which Nebuchadnezzar set up. All right. When these boys came to talk about the three men, they said, Nebuchadnezzar, you set up in Babylon three men. Yes, I did. You set them up. And he said, the three men whom you set up, they did not bow to the image which you set up. So he said, one set up goes against the other set up. And he said, if you don't take down the image, you'll have to put them down. And he says, they don't regard you. And they put a very, very serious slant upon it. You know, actually, there's a very solemn side comes into this. When it comes to the bit,
The world has absolutely no time for the child of God. But it comes to the crunch.
Now, who was it did this criticism? Well, you notice the Bible says it was the Chaldean. Who were the Chaldean? Well, again, if you forgive me, I'll go back in my word and I'll steal into the previous chapter. In the previous chapter, when Nebuchadnezzar had that dream, he called in the Chaldeans. He says, "Gentlemen, I have had a dream." And he says, "You boys will have to tell me what it means or else you're dumb." And they searched and they studied and they scraped about and they hadn't a clue. And they were all under a death sentence from Nebuchadnezzar. There wouldn't have been a Chaldean left. These were the astrologers and the clever men of Babylon. And Daniel came in, and because Daniel was able to interpret the dream, he saved their skin. Now, the very men that owed their lives to Daniel in chapter 2, these are the very men that are going to get Daniel's friends put into the furnace, if they can. These three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, I think they were good at their job. You know, they weren't able to say a thing. They weren't able to say that Shadrach by the swindler. And that Abednego by doesn't work at all. They never mentioned their job. I think they were good at their job. But just because these men wouldn't compromise on this one point, I don't bet they were going to do away with them. You see, the world loves the Christians. Actually, you would hardly believe it, that medicine and education and social reform has nearly always been started by Christians. And the world that we live in tonight, they hate the gospel, but yet what the gospel has produced has been of great benefit. But if the crisis comes, no matter about the benefits of the gospel, they would still put the people to the stake that preach it. Now, especially younger Christians, can I say, I don't mean you to go about hostile. We want to win people for Christ. But I'm talking about the world system. The Lord Jesus said, "They hated me." And he says, "Don't you even doubt it." He says, "They'll hate you." That's if you're like me. But he says, if you're not like me, he says, they'll be very happy with you. But he says, if you're going to be like me and love me, they'll hate you. And these critics, they showed their craft and the way that they did it. Well, I want to think about the cross-examination of their faith. If there was pressure before that, I tell you there was some pressure when the word came, Nebuchadnezzar wants to see you there. I can see the three men going into the audience chamber of the great Nebuchadnezzar. There must have been, the atmosphere must just have been electric. There were plenty of men went into his audience chamber, never came out alive. Nebuchadnezzar asked him, he says, "Men, is it true? Is it true?" Now, I was interested just today to notice that Mr. Newbery puts in his margin against that little expression, "Is it of purpose?" Now, the old boy, try and follow this carefully. He was a psychologist as well as a politician and all that. He said, "Tell me, gentlemen," he says, "I have heard that you men didn't die." He says, "Tell me." He wasn't asking, was it true? He knew it was true or not. But he says, "Tell me this." He says, "Did you not die of purpose?" He says, "Did you really intend not to bow?" He said, "Did you get the message all right?" And he was seething with rage. Because he knew, if these three men don't bow, it defeats my whole purpose to have unity. You know, I don't want to get into another sidetrack here, but I want to tell you, you see, when unity comes here, and if the Lord hasn't come, and you see, when they get all this stitched up that they're working on, if we happen to be the odd ones out, may God help us. Because there's nothing, once politics and religion
gets married. The clusters that don't conform will have to go.
Now, he says, did you do that on purpose? He said, actually, gentlemen, he says, it's a very serious thing. He says, if you're prepared to bow now,
you see, I think there are many. There are many who have taken an initial stand. And then when the pressure gets a wee bit more, they cave in if they can get a loophole. But here were men, even when they were cross-examined, and I can't go into, that's the details there in verse number 14 and 15. Now he says, if you don't worship, he says, you'll be, and he says, who is that God? He let the cat out of the bag when he said this. He says, who is that God that can deliver you out of my hands? Who did he think he was? Who did he think he was? Well, he thought he was God. He didn't say, who is that God who can deliver you out of my God's hands? But who is the God who can deliver you out of my hands? Well, he'd have to learn. You see, Nebuchadnezzar wanted the worship of man. That's why he wanted the worship of this great big image and the deification of man. If I had time, I would like to speak about the serious philosophy of humanism. The worship of man and the greatness of man that's just stalking the whole world and so on. Now, that has been the challenge to their faith, the critics of their faith, the cross-examination of their faith. What about the confession of their faith? Well, these men stand firm. And they say, Nebuchadnezzar, they said, our God is able to deliver us. Our God. He said, what God is there? They said, our God is able to deliver us. And he said, he will deliver us out of your hand. And he's able to deliver us out of the furnace. But he says he mightn't. And I'm clumping two together, for I don't only want to speak about the confession of their faith, I want to speak about the caution of their faith. It might nearly seem to us to be a little bit of weakness, because they did not stand up and say, put us in the fire you like, because God will take us out of it. No, they said, he could take us out of it, but he says he mightn't. And he says, even he doesn't, we are still not going to bow. We know that it's your commandment, but our God gave us a commandment away back many years ago to bow down to no graven image. Jack, you say, have a bit of sense, man. Sure, that was for a way up in Israel. And God told that to Moses away back in Mount Sinai 1,000 years ago, and he told that to the people that were going to the promised land. But sure, that's 1,000 years, and you're in Babylon, and Nebuchadnezzar has given a command. Forget about that old antiquated command of God. No, here were men away from home, and well, a good bit down the line of history, and they would still say they had to obey God before Nebuchadnezzar. You know, the commands of the Bible are never out of date. It doesn't bring us to an important subject here that I just have time to say a little bit about. I'm thinking especially of the way the faith of these men said, he could deliver us, but he may not. But we're going to trust him all the same. What do we say at times when God doesn't do the things that he could do? What about that relative of yours that's suffering of cancer? God could raise her up, but he mayn't. Are we always right? Is it always an expression of faith when we hear about a person being sick to immediately ask God to raise them up to health and strength? Is that always faith? These men didn't seem to think that. These men seemed to think that God could keep us out of the fire, but at the same time it might be his will that we go into the fire. And they said, whatever he does, we are prepared to bow to his will.
But Nebuchadnezzar, we bow to God's will, but we are not going to bow to your will. You see, the will of God is a very, very difficult thing. Tell me this, dear Christian, and if I'm put in circumstances where I'm tested about this, and you hear about me having caved in, don't be too hard on me, because I think that's likely what will happen. Is having to die the worst thing? This relative that you have is sick. What is the best thing that God could do for that relative? You say, I think the best thing that God could do for my relative is take her home to heaven. And yet you say, Lord, we know that's the best thing, but we want you to do the second best. Because it suits us. Well, that brings us to another big subject. You see, these men went into the fire, as we'll be talking about in a minute. Maybe I should just move on to that. What about them in the crucible? The crucible of their faith. It must have been a... I've tried to imagine it many a time in our minds. What it must have been for these men just to be tied up. They knew this was it. The thing that they were put into was likely what we would call a brick kiln. And they likely dumped you into through the top. Likely built on a slope with all this stuff burning down underneath. And they dumped you into through the top where the smoke came out and so on. And when the boys were putting them in, dumping them out over the edge, that's when the boys got burned. But then, probably down the side, there was a kind of a doorway where spectators could watch. So they put them in at the top, and Nebuchadnezzar, he got down to the side. And they were. It must have been quite an experience for these men when they were just going out over the edge. And it has reached now the crisis point. These men had expressed their confidence in God to such a degree that I think it was well worth God's while keeping them alive. These men were such a testimony that I think God said, I'll bring these men through this fire, because he said, men of caliber like this, he said, there'll be a mighty testimony for me on the other side of this furnace. There are occasions, I don't want to say this rashly, because again, if I'm tested, I would quiver very much. There are occasions, brethren and sisters, when people get into trials, and maybe the Lord would have better taken them. There's a fellow called Hezekiah in the Bible, and he pleaded with the Lord for 15 extra years. They didn't turn out well, sure they didn't. It would maybe have been better if he had gone with the boy. But here were men, and these men were of such pure faith that it was well worth the Lord's while having them for their through. Now, what did the fire do to them? Well, they were two beautiful things. You know, we don't like trials. And I know I'm speaking down tonight to people, and I'm really ashamed to speak to you, because you have been in furnaces, and you have been in fiery trials that I have never, and probably will never, know anything about. When these men got into the furnace, it did two things for them. The only thing it burned was the fetters that the Babylonians had put around them and gave them freedom. And the second effect it had, it brought them closer to Christ than they'd ever been before. Because I think that these men in that furnace, they had a revelation of the second person of the Trinity that they never had known previously. In that furnace, they got freedom from the bonds of Babylon. And in that furnace, they got fellowship with Christ. the companion of their faith. I wanted to speak about that. You know, old Nebuchadnezzar, he couldn't. He just couldn't. He says, he really forgot himself. He just didn't know what. He says, hey, we'll put three. He says, there's four. There's four there. Four. And he says, a woman about. He expected to look into that furnace and see men, if not already incinerated, to see men writhing in pain. These three men were walking about, and another person with them. He says, there's something strange about this. He says, these men, there's something supernatural about this. You know, it has often happened, hasn't it? You have seen Christians, and certainly I have seen them from a distance, and you knew that they were in a crucible of life circumstances, and the way in which they were able to move, and the freedom of soul, that you couldn't help but draw the conclusion that there's somebody else with them. And that they are being supported by a supernatural presence. He said, we put in these three men. But he said, I see a fourth. You know, I don't think, and I maybe just couldn't prove this, I don't think that Christ joined the men in the fire. I think he was there before the men landed. And the reason that fire didn't touch them, in the sense of injure them, was because he was there to protect them. And I think he stayed. When Nebuchadnezzar called them out, he still stayed until they were out, and then he left. He had to do that, of course, because he had promised earlier in the Bible, when thou passest through the fire, I will be with thee. I want again to come back to what I was at earlier. Sometimes we think that the worst that can happen to a Christian is death. And I'm not saying this stoically, and I'm not saying this harshly, but dear fellow believers, just let us always remember that in a Christian's life there are things far worse than death. You say, like what? Well, what about denying the Lord? What about a breakdown in testimony? You see what I mean? These men felt that if in any way we should bow and give in to Nebuchadnezzar and deny the Lord that brought us from the furnace of Egypt, we would have cast a reflection upon the God of our redemption. And they were prepared to go through the fire. And then when the Lord saw the faithfulness and the trust of these men, he not only allowed them in the trial, stayed with them during it, he brought them out on the other side to be a bigger testimony than they had ever been. And they had a companion. And again, I know there are some in this meeting, and if you would speak out, and you're not even dreaming of doing it, but you can speak into the chamber of your soul, and you know that there have been times when you have come into narrow circumstances in life, and the heat and the pressure was upon. And as you look back upon those circumstances, you can say very quietly and humbly that you knew the presence of the Lord closer in those days than you did when things were easier and when things seemed to be brighter. I will be with thee. Maybe I'm speaking just to move the thing a little bit further. Some of the boys or some of the girls here at school, you might meet a challenge in your study. In fact, I heard about a person, I'll not just say where, but a long distance from here across a very broad stretch of water in another continent. And she was at her study. And I think the old lecturer, a humanist, I think he picked out that this girl was a Christian. So in his secular wisdom, he said that all the lectures on such and such an afternoon would take place in the local pub. She said, no, sir. He said, you'll be there. She said, I'll not be there. He said, you'll be there. She said, I'll not be there. Well, he couldn't make her go. But he gave her a pile of what we would call homework or assignments. That was absolutely crucifying. Much of it little to do with the core. He made her life almost impossible. Get to the end. She came out at the end with the exams, with first class honors at the end of the core. You see the pressure? And she was able to testify that with all those additional work, she tried to keep a little part of the day for reading the Bible, and a little part of the day for praying, and she tried to keep her soul right with God. I'll tell you, younger ones or older ones in the meeting, if you have Christian principles and Christian convictions, they may be costly. But remember, no matter how much they may cost, from the standpoint of this world, what you will gain through the companionship of Christ, it will be more than an abundant compensation. The thing's over, and I have to get nearly to the end. They're walking out. Just as I've been saying about that girl, there's a confirmation of their faith. I remember the old brother, well, it wasn't that old really, the brother from Scotland telling us about these men, and he used to say when they went into the furnace and so on and came out without any stuff on them, he said they wouldn't bow. And when they came into Nebuchadnezzar, they wouldn't budge. And they wouldn't beg. And they wouldn't buckle. And he said when they put them in the fire, they wouldn't burn. And of course you needed to be a Scotchman to say that. Bow, bend, burn, buckle. And you know, it really sounded good. It was really a good sermon. I was tempted to preach it. That's the kind of men. They couldn't make them burn. And they weren't even singed. And they weren't even scorched. Not a singe, not a scorch. Take a sniff, not even a smell. Look at their skin, not even the slightest scar. Because it was trust in God that put them in. It was the power of God that kept them when they were in it. And they came out on the other side unscathed. It's great to know. Again, for those of you, I feel especially for younger folks and universities and even in early employment and the multiplicity of temptations. Remember, you keep your soul right with God. And what these men said is still true. Our God is able. It's a difficult world, but people can be brought through. And when they get there, not even the smell. It was the confirmation of the whole business. Of course, old Nebuchadnezzar had to acknowledge this. When he gets to the end of the chapter, he has to offer these men a compliment. He said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego." And you say, he knocked down the golden image. I think he didn't. He was no convert. He said, there's something here that I can't come to terms with. He says, these men have a God. He says, I reached out my wretched hand to try and choke them. But he said, the God that these men have, he says, he just took them gracefully from my hand and left me with absolutely nothing. Then the poor creature, you know, he put a decree. He says, right throughout all the peoples and languages and nations of my vast empire, he says, let there not be a man that will dare to say a word against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego's God. He said, but sure, the whole thing's defeated. Gee, you told us, you spent an awful time at the start of the meeting telling us that he wanted all these nations together with this great big image so that he would have one world religion and they would all worship this one great big golden God. That's what he wanted. And before the chapter's over, he said, nobody in my kingdom say a word against the God of Daniel, the God of Meshach and Shadrach and so on. So the unity that he was looking for, he has forgotten about it. And the worship that he tried to prohibit is the very worship that he ends up protecting. And I just say, at the end of it all, that God is still on the throne. And remember, no matter how things work out, and no matter who rages, and no matter who opposes, dear brethren and sisters, evil will be defeated.
and God's purpose will triumph in the end. Isn't it great that we are just these three men? I was thinking this morning, if I had been one of the three, any of these men, when I knew it was the day for the big show, I'd have been Shadrach, I would have phoned up sick. And if I had been Abednego, I would have phoned up and said, Abed, this morning, I'd keep out of this. I'm just not going to be there. And you know the way people think it off, say, these men said we'd take it as an opportunity to stand for our God in the teeth of opposition. They stood for God on the floor of the plain. God stood for them in the heat of the furnace. And all things turned out for his eternal glory. Of course, in the bigger sense, these men will be like the tribulation saints in the future that will go through the fire of tribulation, the seven times heated furnace, the 7 years of tribulation. They won't bow to the image of the beast in Revelation 13. That's all to do with the prophecy of Daniel. We leave that all for some other fellow some other day, but it's very, very, we have just looked at the practical lessons. And I want to just finish with this. You know, Nebuchadnezzar, he paid them a compliment. Now he says, these boys, he says, all throughout my whole empire, he says, I want you to know that these men trusted. And I want to just mention this expression as we close. And he says, they yielded their bodies. Not a big thing. Yielded their bodies. Held nothing, but they yielded their bodies, even though it meant the fire. Part of my reading today, my historical reading, was back to do with Ridley and Latimer. And when they were at the stake, Hugh Latimer spoke across to his friend Ridley. And the faggots were beginning to kindle. He says, be of good courage, brother Ridley. For he said, by the grace of God, we shall this day light a candle in England, such as shall never be put out. Thank God for men that can stand like that. What about the two Margarets on the Solway Firth? And they put the old lady out as the tide was coming in, and they put the young lady here. And the young lady saw the old lady, her head covered with the water. They said, well, are you going to recant now? What about John Rogers, kept in prison, and walking out to the stake at Smithfield, and with a procession going out to die? He saw amongst the crowd his wife, with her little children standing beside her, and a little infant in her bosom, whom he had never seen. And he went across and he spoke to his wife, and instead of her comforting him, he comforted her. And with composure, he walked out to the fire. What about that man in the Sudan? Not so long ago, they took him with his friend because he was a preacher of the gospel. They told him to go across a bridge. They knew. They let the friend go, and the friend told the story. His gospel preacher friend walked across the bridge, and as he walked across, he was whistling, there's a land that is fairer than day. And by faith, we can see it afar. And the Father waits over the way. And the shot ran out. And his body tumbled into the river. And before his body hit the water, probably his spirit was already at the land that is fairer than day. It's happening still. You know, it amazes me, brothers and sisters, that Christianity in the north of Ireland, this is not a story, Christianity costs us so little. And we're hardly prepared to pay the little that it does cost us. Brother said to me at the door last night, he says, we used to walk to this place. And he said, we used to cycle 20 miles to meet it. He says, it is all changed. We were talking about commitment. I don't want to go back on that, but may God help us. Here were three men with a smaller Bible than us, and the Bible says they yielded their body. We can't do any more. And may God preserve us from the sin
of doing any less, shall we pray.